Hello and welcome to the Journalism.co.uk podcast, a show where we bring you insights from media industry experts to help journalists do their jobs better. I'm your host, Jacob Granger. Today, we're talking about how women's magazines have remained relevant to their target audience. There's a brand new podcast out called The Mag Hags Podcast, where journalists Frankie Cookney and Lucy Douglas take a retrospective look at women's magazines from the 70s through to the early 2000s. As they flick through the pages, what's clear is that times have changed. A lot. There's a lot to be desired from the yesteryear of women's magazines, like the fearless yet tongue-in-cheek reporting on topics that women could get nowhere else. But there's also plenty to wince about, like the outdated language and lacking representation, which have naturally come a long way since. We'll pore over what has stood the test of time and what hasn't, with one big question. What has helped women's magazines endure through the rise of digital and social media? The answer to that question is coming up. Stay tuned to find out. Lucy, Frankie, welcome both to the Journalism.co.uk podcast. It is a pleasure to have you both on the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Thanks for having us.
We're going to talk today about what's hot and what's maybe not so hot in the world of women's magazines. You're the co-hosts of a new podcast called The Mag Hags podcast. Oh, that's a bit of a tongue twister. I didn't realise that. Which is, you know, a deep dive into how far women's magazines have come over the last 40, 50 years. And it all starts with you kind of picking up an old issue of titles like Cosmo, flicking back through the pages, you know, scrutinise some of the topics, some of the language, the tone of voice, all those good stuff. So I guess my question to begin with is, do you actually have to go back and buy one of these vintage copies of the magazine to do one of these episodes?
Yeah, we have been. Just on like eBay and Etsy and places like that, like collectors who kind of have them and sell them, or people who are just having a bit of a clear out and making some money off things. So yeah, that's how we've been getting hold of them.
Frankie, how much does a copy of Cosmo from 1982 cost?
On eBay, about a tenner, I would say, which doesn't feel too bad. I think, you know, we could have gone to the library to look through the archives or whatever, but there's something about having the physical magazine in front of you. And, you know, for both of us, you know, we kind of come to this from a place of being magazine readers, growing up reading magazines. And so there's definitely something really nice and nostalgic about actually the magazine arriving on the doormat and feeling really excited about, like, ah, I can't wait to dig into this and see what's inside it. And then also because we've been needing to discuss all the features in quite a lot of depth, so we've needed to kind of send each other pictures and that sort of thing, which is much easier when you've just got the physical magazine in front of you.
Yeah. I didn't just pull that 1982 Cosmo from the recesses of my brain. That was, of course, the focus of your first episode on the show. Let's take a listen.
It's Cosmopolitan, October 1982.
Amazing. I'm so glad we're starting with Cosmopolitan.
Are you ready to check out what's on the cover?
I definitely am.
We have got It's Lovely But Tactful Sex Tactics.
Amazing.
Body Workshop, How to Have a Flat Stomach.
Classic.
On the Pill for 21 Years, Cosmo Reports, What Every Woman Should Know About Men and Marriage. I absolutely love this because I feel like this is such 80s magazine copy. What Every Modern Woman Should Know.
Yeah, that is classic, like, journalese, isn't it?
Totally, yeah. So then we've got a contest. There's an excerpt of some fiction. And then we've got Love and Violence, The Shocking Alliance, and Sex, Society, and the Strapless Top.
Amazing.
And the final one, A Woman's Place is in the House. Take our course that paves the way to power.
Okay. I'm guessing, like, is House capped up?
House is capped up, yes.
Lucy, why did you want to start there with that issue in particular?
One of the things that we really found, and part of the reason that we kind of embarked on this project in the first place, was we kind of knew that we would look back at, you know, 40, 50-year-old magazines, and there would be loads of bits in there that felt really dated and almost quite funny. But there was a surprising amount that felt really current and still really relevant to today. Mm. And I think that was what we were kind of most keen to explore. So like the issue of Cosmo that you mentioned, there's the lead feature that we talk about is a sort of retrospective oral history of the pill, which was 21 years old in 1982. And all the complaints that women had about the pill in 1982, they're still the same complaints that women have about the pill in 2024. So yeah, like looking at things like that, it's like, we've come quite far in some ways, and in other ways, we haven't come very far at all.
For sure. Did you go in with any sort of preconceived ideas of some of the themes that you might explore and what you might find, you know, looking at these topics and these articles, you know, 40 years later?
I think we were kind of expecting to look at a lot of the sort of, like, the sex advice, the lifestyle, the advice around, like, yeah, lifestyle and being a sort of working woman and going out into the world of work, possibly for the first time. I think the other thing as well, because this is something that gets leveled at the media, you know, quote unquote, a lot, is like diet culture and perpetuating a certain like ideal body image for women and that sort of thing. And I think we were both quite curious to see how that would play out across women's magazines.
And what's the answer to that question? How has that representation changed?
I actually think that a lot of the really toxic stuff came after the time period that we look at. So I think the really bad stuff came in the noughties. There were undercurrents of it in the 70s, 80s and 90s, but it hasn't showed up quite as blatantly as I thought it might so far, the ones that we've looked at so far.
I mean, we've had in the very first Cosmopolitan we looked at, there's a feature called How to Get an Absolutely Flat Stomach, which we don't talk about in depth in the episode, but certainly the language in that feels very dated. Toxic's quite a strong word. It really isn't as bad as we thought. And then there's a hilarious little piece in The Honey from 1976, isn't there, Lucy, where it's basically like a workout feature with like workouts you can do in the bath. And that obviously just feels so ridiculous to us. Like, what, you're commandeering my bath time now? No, I'm not working out in the bath. Yeah, that was definitely something we've been curious about, because I think so many women growing up, definitely millennials and certainly, you know, Gen X as well, grown up feeling like there was definitely a sort of ideal body image and pressure on women to look a certain way. And so we've been curious to see how that shows up in the magazines.
Yeah. And how do you think that lands in today's culture?
Yeah, I'd say that's one of the stark differences, looking at magazines in that time period versus magazines now. And not just like body size and shape diversity, but like racial diversity. There's loads of glaring examples in these magazines of like language that would now be considered quite exclusionary. Like in any kind of relationships feature, it's just, you know, it's obviously just assumed that you're in a relationship with a man, and depending on which time period it is, you may well be married to him. You're probably married to him. That wouldn't be a base assumption now. The racial representation in, I mean, it's all white faces. In a couple of the 90s issues that we've got to, that you start to see one or two faces that aren't white, but it's like Naomi Campbell. Mm. Or Iman. That's kind of it. So that's something that's like massively changed, like obviously for the better.
So let's take an example about a reader called David who wrote to Cosmo asking them to cover celibacy from the men's point of view. Cosmo then decided to run a feature inviting David in to talk about it with the editorial team. And here's how that went.
Okay, so what's David's issue apart from the fact that they haven't discussed celibacy from a man's point of view? What's David's burning position on celibacy that he felt so compelled to write in?
I mean, I guess he just wanted to share his experience, which he does. You know, he talks about having lived with a girlfriend and it kind of didn't work out. And then he decided to, you know, for whatever reason, he swore off sex. But the conversation really quickly gets quite combative.
As all good counselling sessions should.
I feel like David has turned up and is sort of trying to explain his experience. And he's just having these two people get quite cross with him.
I have to say, like, I was absolutely obsessed with this feature. Like, it's so completely unhinged. Like, the premise is kind of like a sort of proto Esther Perel type feature, but gone wrong. The language of the whole thing and the whole tone is so like buck up and very sort of cruel to be kind and tough love, which feels so, so of its time. Mm. Like, very sort of, you can't expect to be happy if you're just going to sit around whinging.
Yeah, it's kind of a bit Thatcher in that way, isn't it? What's wild about it as well is that there's so much editorialising. Every time Erin or Jeff say anything, the copy sort of reads, Jeff pointed out, Erin asked, Jeff said. But every time David says something, it's like, asked David a little desperately and glared David in response. Like, he's really been stitched up.
Are women's magazines more homogenous now in how they're written and the sort of, you know, language, tone of voice? Is that slowly being, you know, stifled or not?
I would say not. I've written for a fair few glossy magazines and I definitely think there was a lot more freedom for writers in the 70s and 80s, even into the 90s. I mean, there's certainly, like with this New Woman, clearly they had a very strong house style. So anyone who was writing for New Woman in the 90s would have been writing to that style. It's just that the house style was so punchy and the word that's coming to mind is feisty, which is just probably the most 90s word I can think of. But I think, you know, particularly with the Tatler in the 80s, like that writing was just, you know, there's a real edge to it that I don't think you would get away with that now. And, you know, even the very first magazine we looked at, The Cosmo from 1982, there was a feature in there on 21 years of the pill. And there were all these sort of like linguistic flourishes. You know, he sort of referenced a Margaret Atwood book at one point, and not even sort of one of her more famous ones, and just all these little things that I think nowadays, I mean, they just get subbed out, but they're kind of seen as self-indulgent. But it was really fun to read, and I think certainly as a writer I felt a bit like, oh, I missed the glory days, you know.
One thing I think that has been lost from women's magazines today that I really think they would do well to get back is a sense of fun. I think a lot of like the women's magazines that we've looked at, like one of the things that's really stood out is how, and also like not just the ones we've been looking at, but in our sort of memories of reading magazines and falling in love with them when we were young, was how like fun they were and how much silliness was in the pages. Silliness and seriousness, like alongside each other.
Yeah, I was going to say, it certainly doesn't preclude reporting on serious issues, does it?
No. But I think now, I think about 14 years or so ago, around the sort of Catlin Moran, How to Be a Woman time, something happened where magazine said, our readers are really smart and they care about what's going on in the world, and we need to tell them about like feminist issues that are happening in the world, which is really, really great and really important. But I think we've possibly gone a little bit too far one way, where everything is and kind of loses some of the like poking fun at things, laughing at itself.
Also just leaving things open to interpretation. So I'm thinking about, there's an episode we just recorded on a 1997 issue of Marie Claire, which the episode itself will be out in December. And there's a feature that we looked at in that, which is about sort of medical tourism, people going abroad to get cosmetic surgery. It really just tells the story, but it doesn't analyse it. You know, there's not much editorialising in terms of delving into the ethics of what's going on. The story is just laid out for you. From my point of view, that's the kind of journalism that made me want to get into journalism. And I do feel like now a lot of magazines feel like they need to sort of cover their backs a little bit. Like, you know, if something seems problematic in a story, they sort of need to flag it. Like, you know, obviously this could be an ethical thing and let's talk about that. But in terms, from the point of view of the reader experience and the storytelling, we really loved that this feature just didn't do that. It just told you the story and you went along for that ride and you came away with your own thoughts and feelings about it.
Right. So to summarize some of what you said there, I mean, at least what I've heard, like these golden years of women's magazine writing, quite fearless in their approach by the sounds of things. And what social media in particular has done is made them a little bit more cautious of the backlash of the audience, but also a little bit more meeker in terms of what they're willing to write about.
To some extent.
How fair of a summary is that so far?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, there's also obviously the increased sort of need to appease advertisers in a landscape where advertising is just not going to these publications anymore. It's going elsewhere. It's so scattered. So there's a lot of different factors, I think.
I do think the kind of when that would have changed does quite neatly coincide with, like, you know, Twitter being a really big thing and Instagram sort of becoming a product that people use all the time, and magazines having that much more immediate, direct interaction with their readers in a way that they hadn't necessarily before. So yeah, able to get that sort of response really quickly if people thought that something they'd published was extremely insensitive or contributing to a kind of negative social norms. You know, that probably started out as a positive, but now I think it's potentially got to a point where it makes editors quite conservative in decision making, and, you know, completely understandably.
I've had friends who have been told by magazine editors, like, no, we can't run that, it's too contentious, we'll get too much backlash online. And, you know, from my point of view, kind of, I've never been on staff at one of these magazines, I'm freelance, and so it's very easy for me to sit here and go, but that's exactly what these magazines are supposed to be doing. You're supposed to be pushing the boundaries. I suppose that's the thing that we feel is a bit of a shame, is that these magazines really were at the vanguard of so many of these issues in the 70s, 80s and 90s, and the need to play it safe has definitely blunted that to some extent.
Yeah, I think so too. I think also part of what made women's magazines in the period that we're looking at so bold and revolutionary and so important in the sort of landscape was that they were providing women often with information that they weren't able to get anywhere else. That's all disappeared because of the internet. So for instance, like, in an issue that we're gonna, that will be in a later episode, an early 90s issue of Cosmo, there's a feature about what to do if you need an abortion, and what, you know, who to speak to, what will happen, what the appointment will be like, who you can take with you, all of those sorts of things that you probably have no idea about if you need an abortion. That's not information that women are going to be getting anywhere else, really. Maybe they might be able to get it from their GP. They might not feel brave enough to go and get it from their GP. So yeah, that kind of function of women's magazines has disappeared because of, you know, technology and the availability of information more widely.
So if that's the case, has the purpose of women's magazines changed at all? If it's not a place to get information that you can't get anywhere else, what is it today by contrast?
That's a really good question. So Frankie and I were actually talking earlier about this, and I think that magazines in general are kind of ripe for a bit of a comeback, but we were sort of saying it's not going to look like magazines have looked like in the past. It will be a new thing that exists in culture now. So I think there's definitely an appetite and a market for a magazine as like a really beautiful product that people want to like be pictured with, share themselves like on social, pictured with, you know, their magazine brand. I also think that like there's a real kind of thing around like fandoms and communities now, right? Especially with younger generations. And I think that a lot of the like independent magazines that have popped up and done really well, something like The Fence, and also magazines that have kind of weathered the decline in print quite well, so like Private Eye, something like that. Like one thing they kind of have in common is a humor, but also really making their readers feel like they're kind of in on the joke, and also kind of give them something really beautiful and premium that people want to kind of show off that they own.
There's something in the fact that people, and again, particularly younger generations, are getting tired of just sort of being a slave of the algorithm and just being served content based on what AI thinks they're into, and an increasing appeal of having that curated for you, which, you know, ironically is what magazines and print journalism used to do. We've got to look forward with it, because I think a lot of people have said to us, oh, could we ever get back to the glory days? And it's sort of the wrong question. Like, no, we're not going back. We never go back. But I think there is a way forward with like really quality print magazine journalism potentially. But we just got to think creatively about what that could look like.
So we're going to take a short double ad break now. First of all, just going to let you know that our digital journalism conference, News of Wired, is fast approaching on the 27th of November in London. This is a fantastic opportunity to network with your peers in the news industry and stay on top of the latest trends like social video strategies and forging a path to sustainability. For an extra day of exclusive access and training, this is really exciting, join our first ever study tour on the 26th of November, where you will visit newsrooms like the Financial Times, Fortune and Metro. Book tickets for the study tour and the News Rewired conference and save yourself £50. All of those details can be found on newsrewired.com. Now for part two of the ad break, and in the spirit of inspiration, the Mag Hags podcast did something really cool with the ads on their show, where they read out vintage ads from the magazine. And I just thought it was a really good laugh. So have a listen.
Should we take an ad break, Lucy?
I think we should.
Not your usual sort of ad break, though.
No. These adverts were taken directly from the pages of Cosmopolitan, October 1982.
Genuine vintage ads.
With a little bit of artistic license.
Of course, of course.
Let's do it.
Okay. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll be right back after the ads.
Do you know what I really hate, Frankie?
What's that, Lucy?
I really hate when I'm in the shower and a vintage car just comes crashing through the bathroom wall.
Gosh, that does sound like you have your fair share of problems, but at least there's one thing you needn't worry about.
It's true. My tampon isn't one of them. Each Tampax tampon comes with a special applicator, so it feels comfortable and natural.
And although you'll hardly notice it, you can count on it being reliable.
Thanks, Tampax.
At this point, you've got, I think, 10 episodes in the can. Not all of them are out, but, you know, subscribe and get the episodes when they come out. What would you say is the big lesson for both of you in terms of how women's magazines have evolved over the last 40 years or so? I'll go to you first, Lucy. What would you say is the big sort of takeaway that you've found over these 10 episodes?
One thing is how much craft there is in making magazines, and how sad it is that there is less of a market for all of that craft and skill, and how much I don't want it to die. I think it needs to stay, because there is so much skill that goes into, and creativity that goes into coming up with these ideas and making them fit totally for your reader, and then putting together a book that looks gorgeous and fun and makes people want to spend some of their time with you, and you know, and doing that month after month. So yeah, I really hope that that doesn't get lost.
So broadly the point is, you know, good quality is kind of timeless. But Frankie, what's been the big takeaway for you looking at these 10 episodes? What are you left with?
I think to sort of sum it up, it's like, oh, we've changed, but we've also stayed the same. I think my big takeaway isn't really editorial so much as just sort of like a cultural observation in how you know, a lot of the language has changed and there's some funny phrasing and we've really enjoyed looking at all of that. And the way that stories are framed has changed. And, you know, certainly in many cases, the people who are commissioned to report on them has changed. The readerships have changed. But at the heart of it, so many of the stories we've looked at are really grappling with the same issues that we are all still grappling with today of, you know, like kind of being a woman in the world, working, managing your relationships, your friendships, like wanting to have a good sex life and a work-life balance, and also maybe some nice clothes. Although, you know, people were making a lot more of their clothes in the 70s and 80s. All these magazines have sewing patterns in, which I love. I'd love to bring that back. I think that's felt really significant because I think there's always a lot of conversation around like generational differences. And we were saying this the other day, Lucy, weren't we? Like as millennials, we're now sort of at that point where we're being phased out of the cultural conversation. And there's this big message for like, oh, you guys aren't relevant anymore. Which, you know, like I'm being facetious, obviously, but, you know, there's definitely the sense of like, oh, we're not the cool kids anymore. And so I think there is something interesting to kind of look back at like what's come before and kind of how we got to where we are and sort of see that through line of like, oh, we're all just people really, aren't we?
Gives new meaning to evergreen content, doesn't it?
Oh, 100%, 100%.
Well, listen, Lucy, Frankie, it's been a total pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks ever so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Jacob.
Thank you so much for having us.
The takeaway for today is this: go back to basics to remain relevant. Women's magazines may not have the same utility value as they did in the past because we now live in a world of abundant digital information. But if there is one timeless quality that has helped it endure, it's that its target audience is still grappling with many of the same issues they were 50 years ago, only potentially in a different light. And they can also get the same enjoyment out of kicking back and flicking through the pages. There might be new science, new progressive standards, new language and literature. It's important to stay on top of that in a world that can let you know quickly if you're not up to scratch. But fundamentally, in order to stay relevant, brand identity and loyalty matters more than ever. That badge of honour of being a Cosmo reader, for example. Details will differentiate your brand, the inside jokes, a signature feature format, the sewing patterns. But what did you learn from today? I'd love to know. Let's continue the conversation. I'm on LinkedIn, Twitter /x@jpgjournalism, or email me on jacob@journalism.co.uk. You can check out all of our episodes on all of your usual podcast platforms like Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Just search and subscribe to the journalism.co.uk podcast. But that's all we have time for this week. I've been your host, Jacob Granger. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.